Much of Ann Beattie's fiction is about people who grew up in the 60s. Her characters from the counterculture often are grappling with alienation. Beattie is often labeled a chronicler of her generation, a label she doesn't accept. Beattie's first New Yorker short story appeared in the early 70s, and since then she's written four novels and collected her short stories in four volumes. Her 1976 novel, Chilly Scenes of Winter, was made into a movie, later called Head Over Heels. Beattie's new novel, Picturing Will, is the story of 5.5-year-old Will and the people whose lives revolve around him. His mother, Jody, a struggling photographer raising Will alone, Will's father, Wayne, who abandoned the family when Will was a baby, and Jody's supportive boyfriend, Mel. Ann Beattie's sense of detail is photographic, and I asked her to read an excerpt written in Jody's voice that depicts the relationship with ex-husband Wayne.
The only absolutely distinct memory she had, whether she was awake or during the many times she dreamed it, was of the day they married. They had gone to a justice of the peace. His brother and a girlfriend with whom she had since lost touch had been the only witnesses. After the ceremony, she and Wayne had walked out the door with an arm around each other's waist and made a happy race for the car. His brother had overtaken them and managed to throw open the car door, bowing as if opening the door to a gilded carriage. There had been a split second when she looked down to where Wayne's fingers curved around her waist and suddenly saw their future as clearly as anyone looking into a crystal ball. His fingers were perfectly placed, but you could see how lightly their touch registered. Either the thing he touched was ephemeral, or his touch made it so. This many years later, she still wondered which. But in that instant, she had realized that she would slip through Wayne's fingers.
I think that's an incredibly visual passage that is like, you know, a strobe light has been taken and frozen those characters and those people in that moment, you know, the way a photographer works.
Well, terrific. I do think that photographers zoom in on a detail quite often and hope that that will evoke the entire emotion that they're hoping to get in the photograph. And I have to say that as I was writing this, once I saw that hand as distinguished from, say, the way her skirt looked or whatever, I realized that I had to say something about that hand. I mean, that in effect it was operating metaphorically, but I had to state the metaphor, or it could have worked on any number of levels. I was kind of directing the reader, I hope subtly, as to what to think about their relationship early on.
Picturing Will has a keenly drawn portrait of a young child being raised, and you yourself have chosen not to have children. I'm wondering how you got such an accurate sense of children in your book.
It wasn't hard for me to remember being a child. I think that's really the easiest answer to it. For instance, when I was trying to create the little boy's character, I realized, and I just never articulated this to myself before, never had reason to, I guess, that a child's world is composed of the things the child knows, and since there are so few things that the child knows, really strange connections are made. You know, the child has a tendency to think all these things are interrelated, and as we all know, once you get out there in that big wide world of chaos, the things are not related at all, or not so easily related as you want to make them. But there were many such moments that after having written them, I realized, that really is the way it was, that those really are the delusions under which I hopefully operated.
Mm-hmm. Some of your stories have characters in them that are lost, not quite where to turn next in life, feeling unsuccessful or extremely frustrated, dissipated in some way. Is it a drain on you to write these characters, or do you get kind of charged up by trying to explore the details of their lives?
I don't know that I'd like to have 10 of them together at one time and be sitting around having a cup of coffee with them necessarily. But in some ways, you know, they're a problem to me, and they're a problem to be figured out. There's nothing I want to announce to the reader as being the truth of those characters, but I think that, everything is more complicated than it seems. And so I hope that by the time I finish the particular story, that the particular characters in that story transcend what, from an aerial view, might have seemed like mere isolation or mere alienation to begin with. I do think of them as psychological portraits, in which, of course, I'm not a case psychologist, and so I'm not even trying to solve any sort of riddle.
Mm-hmm. What role did William Shawn have in your life as a writer?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I'm exactly where I am today because of The New Yorker. You know, it was wonderful exposure, and I certainly was richly rewarded, considering that I was living on $3,500 a year when I started publishing in The New Yorker and, you know, acting as a student teacher. William Shaw and Roger Angel, who pulled me out of the slush pile, Fran Kiernan, who was there at the time, were all incredibly supportive and obviously launched a career that I had no idea was being launched.
When you say that Roger Angel pulled a manuscript out of the slush pile, would you just send in manuscripts to the New Yorker?
Yes, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, unsolicited manuscripts that go in unagented, unrecommended, whatever. It's all called the slush pile. That is what happened. I just sent a story to the New Yorker.
How many had you sent them before they took one?
At least 20.
Uh-huh. And did they take any of the early ones later on? What became
of
the earlier
ones? No, they didn't.
Ones?
They didn't. I must say that they wrote me encouraging letters from the first.
I once saw a frightening scene in a restaurant in Berkeley. The editor of a magazine out there was going through her slush pile over a late lunch, and she had the stack of manuscripts that had come in that day's mail or that week's mail. And while she was eating her, I don't know, mozzarella and basil salad with mandarin oranges in it or something, she was opening up the envelopes and quickly scanning a typescript and putting it down in the stack that she was going to be sending it back, quickly putting it back in the envelope in which it had come, spending no more than 20 seconds in some cases looking at a poem, looking at a manuscript in which somebody had probably very carefully typed it out, used the whiteout to make sure every word was spelled correctly. And I thought that's something every writer needs to see, is what goes on in the slush pile.
Well, it's pretty horrifying, and I've seen similar things. I know what you're talking about. I think sometimes, though, it's sort of horrifying how quickly you can tell if something's entirely right or entirely wrong. But often you don't see those extremes. You know, nothing is so horrible in the first paragraph, usually, that you want to throw it over your shoulder. On the other hand, very rarely does absolute brilliance leap out the instant your eyes focus on the page. I just think that the number of people writing and the amount of work that shows up in those offices must drive those people crazy on some level. It certainly would be more than I could deal with. And my only perspective on it really is that I taught for a number of years.
I have a question about the copyright of your book. It's held by Irony and Pity Incorporated.
It's my corporation. This was something that I did under the advice of an accountant many years ago. And when I came up with when I went to the lawyer's office and said, well, I'm incorporating his Irony and Pity, he said, how long do you think that will be funny? And I said, always. It still amuses me very much, but I've taken a lot of bashing for that. It's a line from a Hemingway novel, of course. Jake Barnes is sitting around with his friend in a bar in The Sun Also Rises, and the two of them are getting more and more blasted, and finally the line comes out, Irony and Pity, give him Irony and Pity. So I was giving the IRS Irony and Pity because my accountant said to do so.
You've said that when you get you like to write some snappy dialogue because you like to get a good line off now and again. You sit at the typewriter and laugh as you're writing?
Well, this will be turned against me, but yes, I often amuse myself. You know, the thing about writing is that it really is extremely lonely, and I guess that's fairly apparent. It didn't quite strike me that way until I spent 3 years working on this book and was really, in point of fact, you know, not going on vacation, not going out to dinner and so forth. But and also living in a small town again. I had moved from New York back to Charlottesville, which is a wonderful place to work because there are no distractions. And yet, if you want distractions, it's very nice to be able to go out and find them. And that's not terribly easily done there. But I think just the loneliness of it, I mean, in some ways you contrive little systems that will amuse you and that will fire you up and keep you going. They may never be anything that seem terribly important to the reader, but to you, in jokes, I mean, even things like that, they'll keep you going. It's certainly, for instance, an in-joke of this book that one of my best friends is named Andrew Bornstein, and I have him make a cameo as a little boy rushing off an elevator holding an inflatable palm tree and the mother screaming, Andrew Bornstein, you come back here.
I think those are the things that you know you have to that keep you coming back to the typewriter.
Exactly, but as with any difficult thing, you know, if you think about functioning through some 4-hour period that's traumatic to you, you usually find your little touchstone or your little way around it to function through, and it's no different with writing.
What kind of photographs do you have on your icebox at home?
Somewhat lesser quality than are hung on the walls. Snapshots of friends, funny newspaper clippings.
Do you rotate what you have on your icebox?
Yeah, especially because the freezer part doesn't work, and when things get very wet up toward the top, they get taken off and new ones get put up there.
So you've got clippings and you've got photographs, refrigerator magnets. You have a collection of refrigerator magnets?
I do. My mother keeps me supplied with refrigerator magnets. It says something that she supplies me with typing paper and also refrigerator magnets.
Your mother supplies you with your typing paper?
That's right. Years ago when I moved to New York, she sent me a check for $20 and said, Mama hopes that now you will go out to some lovely store in New York and buy your own typing paper. And I said, no, go back to People's Drugstore in D.C., get more, $1.69, send it UPS. Writers are neurotic, what can I tell you?
I'll move on from the subject of photography here.
I thought maybe you were going to move on from the fact that I was cheap and my mother still supplied me with all these things.
Well, I think, I mean, that's kind of an interesting connection. Was your mother instrumental in encouraging you to be a writer?
I don't think directly so, but she always read to me a lot. Both my mother and father read to me a lot. In fact, one of my father's favorite stories is that he tried to get me to be enthusiastic about going to kindergarten, saying that I could read the comic strips myself if I went to kindergarten. And I asked him what was wrong with the plan as it was currently operating, sitting on his lap and having them read to me. So I can't say that I was exactly ready to race out into the world and become anything, let alone a writer.
Well, Ann Beattie, I'd like to thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you for having me.
Short story writer and novelist Ann Beattie. Her latest novel is Picturing Will, and it's published by Random House. This is Fresh Air.